from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about the history of the now-shuttered Cardinal Stritch University. Then we'll bring you a new episode of Chirp Chat, where we'll learn about why birds migrate.
Contrary to popular belief, a lot of people think it has to do with cold, with winter. They, you know, leave to warmer times, but it really has to do with resources.
Plus, we'll speak with the director of the documentary Sherry and Lamb Chop, which kicks off the Milwaukee Film Festival tomorrow.
Sherry is an unsung hero, and I think that people underestimated her, and when they learn who she is, it's a really great story, and she's really empowering.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The announcement of the closure of Cardinal Stritch had alum like Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski reflecting on what it means to have an institution like this come to an end. To better appreciate how Cardinal Stritch grew to be one of the largest Franciscan institutions of higher education in North America, Audrey went to the archives on campus to meet Sarah Wolfel, the Cardinal Stritch University historian. She says that in order to understand the school and its guiding principles, we have to go further back than when it was founded in 1937.
Any history of Cardinal Stritch University has to start with the sisters. And so I'm going to go well before 1937 to 1849. And that's when the founders of the sisters first stepped foot in Milwaukee. They came from Bavaria. They were invited by the bishop of the Diocese of Milwaukee, which was fairly new at the time. And they came here to serve the German immigrants that had settled in the Milwaukee area. And so from the very beginning, they were putting themselves at the service of the people of Milwaukee, but their heart was with Christian education. And so they had really hoped that they could start a congregation of religious sisters here and eventually branch out into education. And that's something they eventually did, but they had to settle and they had to get their footing first. And they were at the service of the St. Francis de Sales Seminary when it was brand new. So it took them a while to get to education, but as we all know by their history, they not only got to serve in education, but have affected thousands upon thousands of people all over the world because of that.
It's in the name. There's the Sisters of St. Francis of Assisi. And when this was first founded, it was called St. Clair College. So can you briefly go over who were St. Francis and St. Clair, and of course, the Franciscan values that Cardinal Stritch is centered upon?
Well, the Sisters of St. Francis of Assisi were actually the first vowed Franciscan women to be established in the United States. And so from the very beginning, those Franciscan roots were at the heart of who they were. St. Francis of Assisi, he started in a very humble way, just wanting to live in the poverty that would allow him to better serve and know God. It was kind of a radical approach to service, and you know, especially because he came from a wealthy family, it shocked people the way that he served. So little by little, more and more men followed him, and St. Clair was one of the women, the first women to follow him. She also left her wealthy family in order to embrace this life of poverty and service. And so they are giants in the Franciscan tradition.
And can we go over those four Franciscan values? Students who go here, they're required to take Franciscan-infused core classes just to get familiar with it, but also each year the university picks a value to highlight each year. What are they?
Well, this year, our value is compassion, which actually fits very well in this time. We're seeing a lot of compassion during this time. Creating a caring community is another one of them. Peacemaking and reverencing all creation. The sisters are at the heart of that. They articulated those values for the first time in the 1980s because they recognized that the Sisters of St. Francis, who used to be in all areas of the university as faculty, as staff, you couldn't go anywhere without encountering a sister. Their numbers were starting to diminish in the 1980s. So they saw that it was really important to articulate those values so that the people who were left, the lay people who would be working alongside them, could understand what was at the heart of this university from the very beginning and carry that on. And to this day, We have one Sister of St. Francis of Assisi still working here, but we have hundreds, thousands of people who can articulate these values and are living them out in our community today.
You mentioned when this college was first formed, you could scarcely go anywhere without encountering a sister. Can you speak a little bit more upon those early years from Stritch when it was first founded?
The reason it was founded is because the sisters, you know, they were going into education and they were going into schools, but they didn't have proper teacher training. And so they would do the training at their convent. Eventually, they founded something called St. Catherine's Normal School, which is kind of a loose forerunner of Stritch, because they were trying to form their sisters because there was such a demand for teachers at the time, and they needed to get them out into the schools, but you know, they wanted them to be properly trained. So eventually, they started to send them to colleges and universities around the state, around the country, so they could get advanced degrees and methods. But around 1932, there was an unusually large number of sisters who needed training. And so they were looking for ways to get all of them the training that they needed without having to pay out the money for tuition at other schools. And so one of our sisters who was in charge of this, she actually went to the archbishop at the time, and that was Samuel Stritch. And she said, "I don't know what to do. We have all these sisters that need training and we don't have enough money, you know, to send them out." And so he said, "You know, sister, your congregation is large enough now. You can actually start your own college." And so it was at his urging that the school actually started in 1932 as a teacher training college just for the Sisters of St. Francis of Assisi. It quickly changed. They quickly started to embrace other religious orders and bring them in. And by 1946, they started to admit lay women. So it quickly took shape. It started as something very simple and very practical, and it didn't take long before it began to serve a wider population.
You mentioned Archbishop Stritch. So in 1946, the school was also renamed after him, Samuel Alphonsus Stritch. So can you share a little bit more about him and what his local impact was?
Well, he was the Archbishop here before he was then called to be the Archbishop of Chicago, the Archdiocese of Chicago, where he was then named Cardinal. So that's where the name Cardinal comes from here. And I think he was called sometimes the Archbishop of Charity, because he would say, you know, as long as I have two pennies in my hand, one belongs to the poor. So he just really had a heart for people in need. And this was especially during the time that Stritch was founded, during the Great Depression, you know, that really resonated with the sisters because there was a lot of hardship around. There were a lot of people in need. So because he was such an advocate for education as well, the sisters in 1946 had approached him and asked him whether they could name the school for him. And at that time, it was not just Cardinal Stritch College, it was called the Cardinal Stritch College. But he said, yes, as long as you always serve people in need. He wouldn't have wanted his name on a school that didn't have that at its heart. And I think you can trace our whole history and you can see that that is still very much how we operate today.
So we are here in the archives. Can you explain kind of what's all housed in here?
It's a lot of our records, our academic records, our departmental records. There's also, you know, lots of photographs, old publications. One of my favorite things is these old newspapers that we have. We had this award-winning publication from the late 40s to sometime in the 80s. And it was all student-run. So, and it's just, it's their student voices just coming out of those newspapers. We also have some artifacts from Cardinal Stritch himself. We have trophies and, you know, just knickknacks and just, it's, you pretty much can feel the history down here. So what's beautiful about Cardinal Stritch University is a lot of their ministries kind of converged here. One thing I haven't mentioned is that throughout our history with the sisters being here, they weren't just holding space. They were like, they were innovating things. They were creating curriculum around special education. We had one of the first reading clinics in the Midwest was formed here, and it was because our sisters were at the cutting edge of trying to teach people to read.
That's one major impact, and this school was known for its education program amongst many other things. What else stands out to you about the ways that the sisters not only innovated but conducted themselves and cemented a unique place in the field of higher education?
Yeah, I can name a whole bunch of sisters who were known on a national or international level. when they would innovate that curriculum, a lot of times they would share it. This became a place that people would come to learn special education methods so they could take them to the world. So it's just, when you think about the impact of that, it's so far-reaching. I think if you would talk to a lot of the residential students who knew them, the sisters and the students often lived in common ways or common spaces. They'd share meals together. So in addition to these women wanting to form these younger women, you know, to be leaders in society and to form them for their careers, they also had these mothering hearts for them. So I think their legacy is going to be that they put everything that they had into this place. One thing I haven't mentioned is that the sisters contributed their salaries back to Stritch. They didn't take salaries, so it was called contributed services. And they actually, in the year 1968 to 69, their contributed services totaled $430,000. So that was 31% of the college's budget at the time. That was their contributed services because they knew that this ministry was important. And so they gave everything that they had. You hear stories all the time of the sister who, with her PhD, would be teaching in the classroom during the day. And at night, she'd be running the switchboard, or she wouldn't be afraid to, you know, help out in the kitchen or clean the bathrooms. They did not know the limits of hierarchy. They didn't see it that way. This was their school, and they all came ready to serve. So they just have beautiful hearts, and they're still on the south side of Milwaukee. They're so pleased with what Cardinal Stritch University has meant to the community. So even at this closing, they're, you know, sad, but they're celebrating it as opposed to mourning it because they just know what it has meant to people.
Sarah Wolfel was the university historian at Cardinal Stritch, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last year. You can find all of our reporting on the school's closure at WUWM.com. The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in July. You can help shape our coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find the link at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. Coming up, we'll explore the life of Sherry Lewis, a pioneering ventriloquist and children's TV creator, best known for her work with her puppet, Lamb Chop. But first, Chirp Chat will explore why birds migrate and some of the unique breeds making their way to Milwaukee. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you've been outside lately, chances are you've already heard a few new bird songs. Robins, finches, and red-winged blackbirds are all calling out and letting you know it's the start of spring migration. But the best is yet to come. For this month's Chirp Chat, Lake Effect's Excrit Nunez spoke with Aubrey Fulsis, a naturalist and the Children's Events Coordinator at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. She explains why birds migrate and what makes Wisconsin a special place to see visiting birds.
I am so excited to be speaking with you today for the third episode of Chirp Chat. It's sunny outside. Mm-hmm. It's so nice. It's spring. Birds are flying up north and migrating through Wisconsin. But Aubrey, I want to know, why is that? Why do birds migrate?
That is a great question. So migration is basically just any large-scale movement of an animal population from one point to another. Birds are obviously the most famous for it. Over half of the birds in the United States actually migrate to some degree. And contrary to popular belief, a lot of people think it has to do with cold, with winter. They, you know, leave to warmer times, but it really has to do with resources. So the two main reasons that birds migrate are food and nesting sites. So a lot of our insect eaters, they leave Wisconsin in the winter because their food disappears. Their insects are gone in the winter time. And then they come back because once the bugs come back, we have great nesting locations they can take advantage of. Because if they all stayed down in the tropics, they'd be overrun. There wouldn't be any real estate available. So they all come back and find a place to nest up in the more northern hemisphere up by us.
I know something that I've also wondered for a while is, how do birds even know where they're going when it's time to migrate up north or down south? Are there any routes or indicators birds follow?
Yeah, that is a great question. And scientists are still trying to figure out the definitive answer because we can't just ask them, unfortunately. There are some definitive routes that they use. They'll use geographic markers. So one of the main geographic markers in this area is the Mississippi River and the Great Lakes. So it creates kind of this pathway called a flyway. And there are four different flyways in the United States on each coast, kind of along the Rocky Mountains and the Great Plains. And then we're in the Mississippi Flyway. So it goes up from the Gulf of Mexico, following the Mississippi River. And we're kind of bordered on each side with the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River. And it goes all the way up to Canada. So they'll use that. They'll use the sun. A lot of birds actually migrate at night, so they use the stars to help them find their way. There's research that says the indigo bunting uses the North Star to find its way when it's migrating. They'll use magnetic fields. They can actually tell, you know, the parts of a compass. So there's a lot of different ways that they are able to find their way from one location to another.
And you mentioned the Mississippi Flyway, where Wisconsin is in that flyway route. What's unique about it?
Yeah, so it's really the only one that doesn't use a mountain range as one of the kind of barriers. So because it uses a lot of water, we get a lot of waterfowl. So ducks, geese, swans, cranes, they really like to use this flyway because a lot of our birds, some of our ducks, they really never land on grass. They only will ever land on water. So it allows them clear areas that they can stop, like the Lake Michigan is a great stopover site, the Mississippi River, all of our, you know, thousands of lakes that we have in Wisconsin, they can stop at on the way. So that's what makes it a little bit more unique compared to, you know, just having a coast on either side.
Yeah, and so that makes sense. Like when you're going on a long road trip journey, you make pit stops.
Exactly.
What do they do when they might stop through Wisconsin or here in Milwaukee?
Yeah, so it kind of depends. I mean, if you're taking a week-long road trip, you have some stops that are like a gas station, so a really quick stop to pick up food. And then some stops might be a little bit more like a hotel or a bed and breakfast where you stay for a couple days to a week if you can have a really nice area. So around here at our stopover sites like Schlitz Audubon Nature Center, we're a little bit more that, you know, bed and breakfast, that hotel for the birds. We're a really great resort for them to stop at because we have all of the great resources with food. We have protection from predators. We have shelter. We have water. And so usually they're going to kind of stop here. And sometimes they'll stop here and nest. Sometimes they'll keep going on their journey. It really depends on the species.
Wow, I had no idea that sometimes they nest,
on
their stops too.
Yep, we do have some birds that they can keep going up into Canada, but we are still in the range where they're considered breeding areas. So then if they like it enough here, they'll stop and, you know, this is where they end their migration journey and then they stay here all summer.
Do all birds follow one route or another route?
Yeah, so there's different levels of migration all the way from, you know, resident birds who don't migrate at all. So like our birds that stay here all winter and then stay here through the summer, like cardinals, chickadees. And then they can go all the way to what are considered long distance migrants that are traveling thousands of miles for every migration journey. Wow. And that can be something like one of our warblers, the Black Pole Warbler, will travel thousands of miles, including over the Atlantic Ocean, and they can fly up to 100 miles per day. So really a range. And some birds will just migrate just far enough as they need to find food. Those are our short distance migrants. So they're not necessarily following a path. They're more going to where the food is and then hanging out there. And then you have our medium to long distance migrants that are going to follow a little bit clearer of a pathway. And a lot of times they'll go to the same place in Central America every winter and then come back and nest in the same place up here every summer. So you might be getting the same bird over a few years that's making that journey.
That's so neat. And I know you already mentioned a couple of birds, but what are some neat migratory birds that people might see around this time of year?
Definitely. So we already have some of our migrators here. Some of the earliest ones are our red-winged blackbirds. I believe here we first started hearing them right in the beginning of March. The males come back first to claim their territories, and then the females are going to come back later once the bugs are a little bit out a little bit more, and then she'll play a little game of bachelorette and pick which territory she wants to go to. And we've already gotten our turkey vultures back. You can see them, the really big black birds soaring, barely flapping over our heads over in the sky. And we've already gotten our kinglets back. They're very tiny little birds that we see fluttering around pine trees. Probably the pinnacle of spring migration to a birder is warbler migration. So warblers are these tiny neotropical birds, and they winter down in Central and South America, and then they come up through that flyway. And there are a couple that will nest here. Otherwise, they're really only here for maybe a week before they keep going up to Canada, and then they nest in northern Canada. And the beauty of them is that there are so many different types. We have recorded 36 different kinds of warblers here at Schlitz Audubon Nature Center, and they're very colorful. They come in vibrant yellows, and some of them have a little bit of green, some of them have orange, and they're just really fun birds to watch. So that's kind of what a lot of birders look forward to, is that warbler migration, where they're just waiting for them to show up, and then you see them all over the trails looking for warblers.
It sounds so beautiful and so exciting. I actually don't think I've ever seen a warbler, or maybe I've never identified one before. So I'm kind of excited. So when they are coming through, and these birds are already coming through, how can people take care of these migratory visitor birds?
Yeah, that's a great question. As I mentioned, a lot of birds migrate at night, and one of the biggest hazards that they're facing now are bright lights happening at night. So especially in things like skyscrapers, really big business buildings that are leaving their lights on overnight, it really confuses them, especially if they're trying to track using the stars or anything like that.
Right.
And so a lot of fatalities happen when they run into those lights at night. So there are some cities around the country that are starting campaigns called like Lights Out to basically turn the lights off during those peak migration times to help the birds when they migrate through. So that's one way companies or businesses or even individual people can help out. But then just providing them a good stopover site. We talked about the bed and breakfast. Make your backyard a great bed and breakfast for birds. Have water available for them. Have different types of food. Sometimes the birds that are migrating through might be more interested in eating bugs or fruit. So you can have a good diversity at your bird feeders for them to grab a, you know, nice bite to eat. Have some good shelters for them. Have some native plantings that they can have and live in and just kind of rest on their journey.
So as we wrap up, I know we talked about the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center being one of the wonderful places to come see migratory birds, but what are a couple other places people can go check out?
So during that peak migration, you're probably going to be able to find some of these cool migrators at any green space in your area. So checking out some of the county parks that have a little bit more forest, looking by the Milwaukee River and seeing some of those birds in that habitat. And then if you want to take a little bit further of a trip, we're pretty close to a national wildlife refuge called Horicon Marsh, which is known for getting these really cool migrants like whooping cranes and pelicans and some of these kind of bigger, more rare birds. And that's a really fun place you can check out. That's a day trip away.
So at the end of every Chirp Chat, I love for guests to shine a spotlight on a bird for the month. So Aubrey, what's a bird you like to highlight this month?
Yeah, so I want to highlight one of our most notable and recognizable migratory birds, and that would be the Baltimore Oriole. So the Baltimore Oriole will spend its winter down in Central America. It actually likes to hang out near where they grow things like coffee and cocoa. And it'll migrate back up here and it'll actually nest in Wisconsin. So it is this blackbird that has this beautiful, bright orange plumage that is unlike pretty much any other bird we really see in Wisconsin. Like, you see this bird that has this bright orange and it's just absolutely mesmerizing. And they have these beautiful, bright, whistling songs. And they like to sit at the tops of trees and just sing their little hearts out. And I really want to highlight them because they are actually a fruit eater. So down in Central America, they're eating a lot of ripe fruit. And one of the ways that you can help them out and even attract them to your backyard is by putting out things like oranges. So you'll hear oranges for orioles. So you literally just slice an orange in half and you stick it on a stake by your bird feeder, and it attracts these really, really cool, bright tropical birds to your backyard.
Oranges for orioles.
Yep.
I will remember that. Aubrey, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for getting listeners excited about spring migration.
Yeah, definitely. I always say spring migration is like the start of the party. All the birds are coming down and it's just a really, really fun time.
Let's get the party started.
Let's get the party started.
Aubrey Fulsis is a naturalist and the children's event coordinator at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. She spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez for a new monthly series we call Chirp Chat. At WUWM.com, you can hear more of this conversation and find last month's Chirp Chat, all about the importance of bird names. Every Milwaukeean has their favorite fun facts about the city, something no one else seems to know. Now a new book has gathered dozens of those stories into one collection. Secret Milwaukee by Jim Nelson is full of fun, lesser-known stories about the Cream City, and he shares a few of those stories with me. There are a lot of stories in here that I think some, like, die-hard Milwaukee history people are going to go, oh, yeah, I know this and
right.
that story. But what are the stories that you found as you were doing this that you went, oh, I didn't know about that. Oh, this is interesting.
Well, I'd have to say the biggest one for me, I don't know where I'd been, but the treasure of Byron Price. So there's a total of 84 locations in the book. That number was given to me by the publisher. And I had a good 75 to 80 ideas, you know, that I was working on, but I needed like those last few. And so I decided to crowdsource it using Facebook. So I put something out and said, like, hey, is there something you'd like to know more about? Something strange, weird, or obscure? And a friend of mine told me to look into this and said that she and her family are just like obsessed with trying to find this treasure, this buried treasure somewhere in Milwaukee. I've lived here my whole life. I had never heard of this. I researched it. Had a blast looking into this, was going all over Lake Park trying to find not this treasure, but so much just like, can I find the trail that leads to the treasure would be nice. So that one was a lot of fun to write.
Of the stories that you wrote about, of course, we're not going to get to 70 or 80 of them. We're going
right.
to talk about just a couple here. But what are some of the ones that you find really interesting that I guess maybe you're surprised people don't know about?
One of the more surprising concepts, I would say, is cemetery history. And that actually bubbles up in a couple of the stories that I wrote into the book. Because once a cemetery is a cemetery, it's kind of hard to move it. Like, it can be done, but it's not done frequently. And when it is done, it's always controversial, like relocating graves and that sort of thing. And so what's happened is as the city and its suburbs have grown and they have taken over formerly rural lands, they now kind of surround some of these old closed cemeteries. And one of the things that's very interesting is they're just kind of hidden in plain sight. Like, you may drive past them, but you don't know that they're there. And oftentimes by design, because the city or the suburbs don't want people kind of trespassing on this cemetery land, and so they've deliberately not marked them. And I know there's one near Levy Cemetery near where I've lived most of my life. I had absolutely no idea it was there. And I started to do some research and I found the old cemetery and got onto the land. And sure enough, there are a couple of graves there and probably a few dozen unmarked graves as well.
Interesting. Now, this is kind of cemetery adjacent, but a story that I learned pretty recently that I know you talk about in your book is Milwaukee's interesting relationship to the origin story of The Exorcist. Now, can you dig into that a little bit?
Yeah, it's true. So there were three priests who were involved in the actual real exorcist, and there's this young boy who was believed to be possessed by the devil. He had grown up in a Lutheran family. Supposedly, an aunt of his introduced him to a Ouija board, and that's, according to the family legend, is what started it all. And when the parents became very concerned because of, like, flying objects and that sort of thing in their home, as one would become concerned, and they initially went to their Lutheran pastor, who evaluated him and said, you're going to need an exorcism, and that means you need to go to the Catholic Church. And apparently the boy was evaluated by a psychologist as well as a parapsychologist who specialized in phenomena of the paranormal, and everyone agreed. It took a while, but they were finally able to find a priest who was able to do it, and he was assisted by two younger priests who needed to hold the boy down. And one of those two younger priests later went on to become a professor at Marquette University and lived here for decades until his retirement, did not talk about it very often in his experiences with that, and he is interred at Calvary Cemetery right here in Milwaukee.
Yeah. It's an interesting just little nugget of history, and I think this book is really just full of these nuggets of history, as it were. What would you say is your favorite bit of history that you put into this book?
You know, I have so many, it's hard to choose. I think one of the stories that I was very just fascinated by was the story of Dirty Helen Crommell. And her book has actually recently, her autobiography has recently been re-released. And it's the story of the most notorious brothel keeper in Milwaukee during Prohibition. Now, for most of the stories in the book, for almost all of them, there's a site that you can actually go to do some touring. So, you know, obviously you can go to a cemetery, that's free, and you can go to some of these historic buildings, and either for nothing or very low cost, you can gain admission and take a look around. But the Sunflower Inn, which Helen managed during Prohibition, it's gone. You know, it's just a parking lot. I actually went to the parking lot and just to kind of reconnect, and I took a picture, ended up not putting it in the book. But her life story, which I'm not going to reveal in this interview because I want you to buy the book, but her life story is just so compelling. How she arrived in Milwaukee, the things that she did here, how she ended up living out her final days, that even though you can't visit the Sunflower Inn, I had to put it in the book anyway. It's such a great story.
Now, most of these are places that you can visit, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
What do you hope people take away from this book? Do you hope that they go on kind of an adventure of Milwaukee? Do you hope they just learn a little bit more about their hometown?
I'd really like to see that a lot. I think that the more we can connect people to places in the community, places they haven't been before, it just helps everyone develop a sense of identity. And when you develop a sense of identity that is Milwaukee-based, you tend to care more about the city itself, as well as the people who inhabit the city. So, you know, sort of one of my big goals is to try to, like, bring people together. But in the meantime, just get out, get to know your city. Each site, each story is only 2 pages long, so it's very digestible. It's easy to read. Find something that you like. Find something that you didn't know that was there. Go visit that, too. And then if you like it, hang around for a while. Have dinner at one of the neighborhood restaurants. Talk to some of the locals in the neighborhood, or read up some more in one of my other books, perhaps, or go online and find something else that you can read about that neighborhood, about that site, about the people who live there and kind of see this book as an entryway to greater learning.
Jim Nelson is the author of Secret Milwaukee, as well as many other books about the region. We spoke in December. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, but ahead of that, we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Then listen for new episodes starting in May, on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. Coming up, we'll take a nostalgic look back on Lamb Chop and the woman who created her, which is the subject of a new documentary. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
So there's only one thing you've got to learn.
What's that?
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Before Fred Rogers and Jim Henson, Sherry Lewis was a true pioneer of children's television. She was a dancer, singer, magician, and showrunner. But Sherry is best known as the ventriloquist behind her trusty sock puppets, Charlie Horse, Hush Puppy, and of course, Lamb Chop.
What are you shaking?
I am not your supporting act.
She kills me.
Through many shows, songs, and specials, Sherry Lewis and Lamb Chop had a decades-long relationship. A new documentary called Sherry and Lamb Chop dives into the life of Lewis and her career that cemented Lamb Chop as an enduring pop culture icon. The documentary kicks off the Milwaukee Film Festival tomorrow night. And ahead of that, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with the documentary's director, Lisa Dapolito.
So a simple sock puppet with long eyelashes had such a hold on us for so long, and honestly, Lamb Chop still does. So before this film was even an idea for you, what was your first memory of Lamb Chop, or was Sherry Lewis herself the person that you were drawn to?
You know, I was in the in-between age group, so I wasn't watching Sherry at the beginning of her career and her early shows, and I wasn't watching Lamb Chop's play along. So I only really knew Sherry and Lamb Chop from like Hollywood Squares and like being on shows. But I remember hearing about the project from a friend of mine, and I was like, Lamb Chop. I had a Lamb Chop lunchbox. I don't know why I did, but I know I had a Lamb Chop lunchbox. So that kind of excited me about the project. And then I started learning about Sherry, and it was really, I mean, I think I'm always looking for stories of really powerful women who are unsung heroes. And I love comedians. And I always felt that she really is a comedian. She's a two-woman, three-woman show, but it's just her. And so I was really looking for a character to do a film about somebody who really touched somebody's heart. And I think Sherry and the puppets have that. And I think Sherry is an unsung hero. And I think that people underestimated her. And when they learn who she is, it's a really great story. And she's really empowering.
How did her parents influence her career path? Because to me, it seems like she was raised to be a performer.
Well, I don't think there ever can be another Sherry Lewis again. If you hear about her background, her father was a professor of math, but he was also the official magician of New York City, which I had no idea that that really was true. And then when I looked up her Abe Horowitz, in his New York Times obituary, it says Peter Pan, the magic man, official magician of New York City. So Sherry's father, he helped kids out who were in trouble, and he would teach them math through magic. And he started these magic clubs, and a lot of the famous magicians you know today are kind of descendants of that line. And then Sherry's mother was the music supervisor for the Bronx schools. So Sherry grew up with both music being a big part of her life and magic being a part of her life, and parents who were extremely supportive in her being both, you know, a musician and a magician. It was right after vaudeville, so she had all jugglers and belly dancers and ventriloquists and puppeteers and all these people in her home. So it was a very magical time, I think.
So, of course, Sherry was multi-talented. She showed off all these talents in her various shows over the decades. But we, of course, know her best as a ventriloquist with Lamb Chop. And as a kid watching this, I didn't fully recognize that, right? Like, didn't know ventriloquism was a term, but watching it as an adult and knowing the skill that it takes to do that. For Sherry, what did ventriloquism allow her to really hone into or to help her express herself in the world?
Well, I mean, she was a woman she started her career in the 50s and 60s, where women really didn't have a voice. And so I think Sherry used her puppets to be able to say things that she couldn't say, such as she used it both in her political ways, like why can't a woman be president, and also in her personal life. Like there's a clip later on where she's having troubles in her marriage and she goes on a talk show and she talks about divorce with the puppet. She has Hush Puppy talk about divorce, which she knew her husband was sitting in the audience watching that. So Sherry used her puppets to say things that maybe she couldn't say, but who would get mad at a puppet?
Right. Well, we have a clip of Sherry and Lamb Chop discussing the possibility of a female president. Let's listen now.
35 presidents, all men. Not one could do the job right. If they had gotten just one girl, she would have been enough.
So Sherry started working, I suppose, like professional, we can call it, around age 24. And her career, she, as you mentioned, was a producer, a writer. She's very much her own showrunner in her shows in the late 50s and early 60s. And while she was so young looking at some of these clips, she was also a massive pioneer of television. You know, a lot of people think of Mr. Rogers as a main person that's an example for children's television, but she, in fact, was the main predecessor to that. So can you explain her impact on children's television specifically, especially when it comes to hosting styles?
I think her first show, Facts and Fun, I think she was around 17 years old. We were able to find that clip, not the clip, we found a VHS or not a master of that show. So Sherry was around 17 at that time, and she was the host of Facts and Fun. So she had a very intimate style with kids. I mean, she was so cute too, and so like personable. I think people related to her right away. If you listen to her songs, even from the beginning, they're all about believing in yourself. They're all about being the best you can be, even from the beginning. And I think she also simplified things for her audience, like games and things you can make. So it was a very personal, very intimate show. And I think Sherry never talked down to children. She talked to children. So I think that was a very important style that she had.
Oh, and especially looking through the lens directly to kids at home, right?
Yeah. You know, back in the day, there was only 3 television stations and Sherry had the prime Saturday morning spots. So she had an audience of, I don't know, 10, 15 million children watching her.
So with that first show around 17 years old, working for decades through her 60s, you know, we were talking a bit before we recorded about how multi-generational Sherry is, and Sherry and Lamb Chop. Lamb Chop falls into that category too. So what were some of the challenges for you of trying to give audiences a good picture of Sherry throughout her life? Because there's so much to go through. I can't imagine all the hours of tape you must have seen.
Well, you know, it's always hard to really get to know who somebody is. And Sherry was very particular about her interviews and how she presented herself. So it was a little bit difficult to find out who the real Sherry was underneath this story. And then we came across this interview that we use a lot in the film about where this one interviewer, I'm sorry, I don't know his name right off the bat, he connected with Sherry and he's like, who is the real Sherry Lewis? And somehow that interview, I think, gave me a lot of information that I didn't have before. So that was really, really important. Also, I have an amazing editor, Andrea Lewis. When she started going, you know, we have all these, like Sherry's library of shows is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shows. And Andrea started realizing that Sherry's using her puppets to tell her story. So when she started pulling out some examples, like there's another example where Sherry's husband is going through this kind of experimental period. And my editor found a clip where Lamb Chop and another puppet are talking, and it seems as if the puppet is high and Lamb Chop is telling the puppet to come down. And my editor was explaining this to me, and I was like, wait, I don't understand what you're talking about. And then she showed me, and I was like, wow, that is Sherry expressing herself through the puppet. So like having an amazing editor in a project like this, which is tons and tons of archival, you know, they can see things that I can't see.
So with Sherry doing so much and having so many puppets, outlets, and ways to express herself, I was kind of grappling with that same question you have, who is Sherry Lewis? Because she said in your film, it was clear that I found myself in myself, but it seemed like even with her family, she was very guarded with truly expressing herself without the medium of puppetry or entertainment. Did that make it difficult for you to try and have that central idea or message in the film? Because in a good way, people are full of contradictions, right? But when you have this major figure like Sherry Lewis, I still found myself like wondering more about her.
Well, it's interesting because like this is something Andrea and I would talk about a lot. You know, there's an interview where Sherry's like, I don't seek.
That's the other thing that stood out to me. There are people who seek and people who do. I don't seek. I think there's just the unfolding. That stood out to me. Yeah.
And I think that's her philosophy in life. And I think that that's how she was able to achieve so much, because she didn't really, you know, stay in the dark times. She didn't really, she just kind of kept going. And I think that that's sort of a, you know, it's a good lesson for people, or at least for me. Yes, it's very easy to get stuck in something, but I don't think Sherry got stuck. So I think that it's not that Sherry wasn't emotional or deep. I think she just had a different philosophy.
Yeah, I came across Sherry and Lamb Chop primarily through her last PBS show. And it was fascinating to know kind of both Sherry and Lamb Chop's different lives of decades before I even came across them and interacted with them in that way. But I feel like a through line with this, even in the periods where Sherry was trying to do new things or reinvent herself, the center of that and what she believed in most to teach to kids, in addition to just the value of educational television, was self-esteem. That was the most important lesson to get. So despite all the contradictions we talk about, do you think that's like what stands out about Sherry Lewis the most is her personal value and self-worth?
I think so. I think she always believed in herself, and she believed that if children believed in themselves, they can do whatever they wanted to, as long as they tried. Like that's, Mallory tells me the difference between Mr. Rogers and Sherry. Like Mr. Rogers is, we love you just the way you are. And Sherry is, we love you, but be the best you can be, like be the best version of you. So I think there's a sort of push in Sherry, like it just doesn't happen by just being you. You have to go for your goals and you have to achieve them. And then, you know, and celebrate them too. Like that's what she said with self-esteem is you teach a child to do something and when they do it, you celebrate it. So I think that's the most important thing that Sherry gives. Like when Mallory does shows with Lamb Chop, sometimes I'll go to the shows and people will always come up to her and say, you know, I had an awful childhood, but your mom was there. So there's something that Sherry was able to empower children just by doing whatever she was doing.
And with the influence of Sherry Lewis being so multi-generational, what's the kind of feedback you've gotten from audiences so far with this documentary?
It's really, really interesting because I think there's the audience that knew Sherry in the 50s and 60s. Then there's the audience that knew her in the 90s. And then there's the in-between audience, which was like my generation, where kind of you knew her on talk shows. And I think with the film, it puts everybody together into one Sherry career. We had a screening and two people the next day came up to me and they said, you know, after the film, I called my mom and I said, do you remember how I used to love watching, you know, Lamb Chop's play along? Like, I feel it is a multi-generational film. Also, people are starting to bring children to the screenings, which I've been, you know, we've all been like, well, they talk about sex a little, we talk about drugs a little. Like, is that something? And the kids are really loving it. Like, they're kind of getting, especially little girls, there's sort of a really good connection, I think, with little girls and Sherry. I mean, it could be little boys too. I just have only talked to little girls. So I think it is a multi-generational film. I don't think Sherry goes, I don't think her philosophy or Lamb Chop or the puppets, I don't think they go out of style. Like Sherry was singing the same songs in 1990 that she was singing in 1956. Mm-hmm. Like it's the same songs. And I think you could sing them today. And another thing is people are starting to discover Sherry on YouTube. Lamb Chop's Play Along. So there could be a new generation.
Lisa Dapolito is the director and producer of the documentary Sherry and Lamb Chop, which you can see tomorrow night at the Oriental Theater as it kicks off the Milwaukee Film Festival. Dapolito will be in attendance for a Q&A after the screening, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. Dapolito spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll speak with the filmmakers behind the documentary No One Asked You. The film follows a collective of activists, writers, and comedians who use humor to destigmatize abortion and fight for reproductive care nationwide. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Wow.
This is a song that doesn't...
Charlie Horse out. And this time, don't slam the door.